Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 23, 2019. This is the 13th week of our Tuesday 2019 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Anuradha Sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So again, this sutta, the Anuradha Sutta, is a sutta on fabrications being the basis for five clinging aggregates. And the Buddha makes that connection. And really the overarching theme is that when we live our life rooted in fabricated or corrupted or perverted views, we're literally not living life. We're living something. We're living a fabricated experience, and that experience is called the five clinging aggregates. But there's no reference towards what's actually occurring within those five clinging aggregates. It's all self-reference. When you hear Saturday's talk, same talk but given by Matt, he's got a great visual that maybe he'll share with us tonight, if I'm not...
Yeah.
And I'll take credit for it. But and you really could say this about almost every sutta, but this sutta really gets to the heart of the matter. And when you make the connection to last week's sutta on the dependent origination, which states that from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, as a requisite condition, comes fabrications. So the solution, again, points right back to developing understanding of Four Noble Truths. Do you want to point that out now, or do you want to wait until...
I'll wait till the end, but okay. I sort of have to find it. The one that I tried to look up on my phone wasn't as good as the one that I have a copy of at home. So I'll do my best.
Okay, thank you. I'll read the sutta. Has everyone read the sutta? What I'm really asking is, did you read the introduction to this? Mm-hmm. Most of you? All of you?
Yes.
No.
Sounds
no.
Like... No?
No.
No.
Are there more people here?
I think I gave it enough introduction so that you'll have the context. And if not, just ask me. If you're confused by it, just please let me know. I have heard the Anuradha Sutta. I have heard that on one occasion, the Buddha was staying near Visali. Venerable Anuruddha has visited the Buddha from his forest hut. While traveling to the Buddha, a group of wandering sectarians encountered Anuradha. The group had common questions for Anuradha. The Tathagata, the awakened one, has been described as having one of these views. The Tathagata, the Buddha, I'm going to use the word Buddha anyway. The Buddha exists after death. The Buddha does not exist after death. The Buddha both exists and does not exist after death. That's something that Nagarjuna made famous in his extrapolation of this. I won't get into it, but that's a common belief, especially in modern Buddhism. The Buddha neither exists nor does not exist after death. So there's a subtle... I didn't say it right. Let me read those last two. The Buddha both exists and does not exist after death. The Buddha neither exists nor does not... I left the word out, does not exist. And so these are questions that arise from a mind seeking to speculate about its own, meaning fabricate its own existence, both in this life and in another life. All of these questions, common questions, still asked today, are rooted in fabrications. They're rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Venerable Anuradha replied that the Tathagata, the Buddha, the awakened one, is not described as having any of these views. So a mind that is stuck in its views will insist that, well, it must be at least one of these. Because if it's not one of these, then what is it that exists? But do you understand it? It's the question itself. Well, what exists after death? As far as the Buddha is concerned, nothing. As far as the Dhamma is concerned, nothing. The question itself is a fabricated question, and it leads to more speculation and more distraction.
Why didn't he just not answer?
Sometimes he did, and it depends on the situation. Now remember, this is Anuradha's getting the question. And so like any one of us, and I've fallen into the trap, not as often as I used to, but when somebody asks you a question, you feel compelled to answer it, don't you? Even if you don't really have the answer, you'll come up with something, because you don't want to look like you don't have an answer.
Would the right answer would have been you're asking the wrong question?
That is a good question. I think in this setting, because they're not really members of the Sangha and don't really understand it, Venerable Anuruddha doesn't want to respond exactly in that way. He wants to give an answer that is consistent with the Dhamma. Excuse me. And that's a little bit off topic, but it's important to understand that. For me to misrepresent the Dhamma at any time is simply leading to more confusion and deluded thinking for other people. So it's one of the things that the Buddha emphasizes over and over again, to be true to his Dhamma, have fidelity to his Dhamma. The wandering sectarians didn't buy it. The wandering sectarian said to Anuruddha, "You are either an inexperienced newcomer or a foolish elder." So much for trying, huh? The sectarians then took their leave of Anuruddha. Not long after, Anuruddha thought, "If I am questioned again by seekers, how will I answer in such a way that will not misrepresent the Buddha's Dhamma?" Even though he didn't. "So that these whose thinking is in line with the Dhamma will have grounds for criticizing. So that those whose thinking is in line with the Dhamma will have grounds for criticizing me," with a question mark. Anuruddha went to the Buddha. He bowed and sat to one side. "Great teacher, a group of wandering sectarians asked me if you hold any views that agree with these views. The Buddha exists after death. The Buddha does not exist after death. The Buddha both exists and does not exist after death. The Buddha neither exists nor does not exist after death. I said to them, friends, the Tathagata, the awakened one, is not described as having any of these views. They then assumed I was an inexperienced newcomer or a foolish elder," simply because he couldn't answer a question that didn't deserve an answer within the framework of the Dhamma. Anuruddha says, "I misrepresented your Dhamma. How should I respond in the future to present your authentic Dhamma so that I won't be criticized by the wise," even though they weren't wise? In this next section relates directly to the three marks of existence. The Buddha responds, "What do you think, Anuruddha?" And it relates directly to the five clinging aggregates. "What do you think, Anuruddha? Is form permanent or impermanent?" Notice immediately the Buddha is not falling back into the trap of answering the questions or even getting into a discussion as to why he's not answering it. He's giving Anuruddha a Dhamma teaching, so he understands from a Dhammic perspective how to properly answer that question. "What do you think, Anuruddha? Is form permanent or impermanent?" "Form is impermanent, Master." "And is that which is impermanent easeful or stressful?" "That which is impermanent is stressful, Master." So as soon as we start identifying with the form, Namarupa, I'm creating stress for myself because it's a fabricated view. "And is it authentic to my Dhamma to join with what is stressful, to self-identify with what is stressful, by regarding what is impermanent, stressful, subject to change, as this is mine, this is myself, this is what I am?" Does everybody see the connection there? Mm-hmm. By joining with the form, and by self-identifying with form is joining to the form, and it is stress-inducing by identifying with it. Is that clear?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this is the beginning of form is the first aspect of five clinging aggregates. Now I got to go back to keep it in summary. "And is it authentic to my Dhamma to join with what is stressful, to self-identify with what is stressful, by regarding what is impermanent, stressful, subject to change, as this is mine, this is myself, this is what I am?" "No, it is not, Master," says Anuruddha. "Well, is feeling permanent or impermanent?" "Feeling is impermanent, Master." "Is perception permanent or impermanent?" "Perception is impermanent, Master." "Well, are fabrications permanent or impermanent?" "They're impermanent, Master." "Fabrications are impermanent." "Is consciousness permanent or impermanent?" Meaning ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. "Consciousness is impermanent, Master." "And is that which is impermanent easeful or stressful?" "That which is impermanent is easeful or stressful." Those are the five clinging aggregates. "And is it authentic to my Dhamma to join with what is stressful, to self-identify with what is stressful by regarding what is impermanent, stressful, subject to change as this is mine, this is myself, this is what I am. There's a lot of commentaries. No, it is not, Master. So the Buddha just taught Anuruddha, that those questions, those great questions that people have been asking since the beginning of humankind, are rooted in ignorance. The proper, it's not even that they don't deserve an answer. The right answer isn't even an explanation of five clinging aggregates. The right answer is a Dhamma that will lead to understanding five clinging aggregates. So it's almost as useless that Anuruddha would have answered, well, the problem is you don't understand form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, or consciousness. That would have had no bearing either. So really what the Buddha is teaching Anuruddha is that there's something missing in his own teaching here. You don't properly understand five clinging aggregates. Anuruddha, do you regard form as the Buddha or as the Tathagata? No, I do not, Master. Do you regard feeling as the Buddha? No, I do not. Do you regard perception as the Buddha? No, I do not. Do you regard fabrications as the Buddha? No. Do you regard consciousness as the Buddha? No, I do not. Well, Anuruddha, do you view the Tathagata as being in form? Do you view the Tathagata as being other than form? Do you view the Tathagata as being in feeling? Do you view the Buddha as being other than feeling? Do you believe the Buddha as being perception? Do you believe the Buddha as being other than perception? Do you view the Buddha as being in fabrications? Do you view the Buddha as being other than fabrications? So he's telling Anuruddha, you got one choice or another. It's either this or something else. The something else is rooted in ignorance. Do you view the Buddha as being in consciousness? Do you view the Buddha as being in other than consciousness? No, I do not, Master. Anuruddha, do you view the Tathagata as five clinging aggregates, as form, feelings, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness? No, I do not, Master. Do you view the Tathagata as without form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, or consciousness? No, I do not, Master. So, Anuruddha, when you cannot describe or establish the Tathagata as a permanent truth in this present life, is it authentic for you to declare that the Tathagata, the awakened one, has any of these qualities you described? No, it is not. So attaching the quality of existing after life or not existing after life, or both existing and not existing after life, or not existing after life and not existing after life, as ridiculous as that is, it's a common question, are all foolish questions and do not accurately describe the Buddha, the Tathagata. So even if you provided a speculative answer that satisfied the questioner, you're still just confusing them, and you're also reflecting your own foolishness, your own confusion, by the need to feel like you have to supply an answer. Let me continue. Anuruddha, you have learned well. Remember what I teach, and this is important because this is. The Buddha's reminding Anuruddha and every one of us 2,600 years later, this most important line that I'm about to read. Hopefully Anuruddha learned it, because then he won't allow himself to fall into speculative applications of the Buddha's Dhamma. You have learned well. Remember what I teach. At all times, it is only stress that I describe and the cessation of stress, nothing more. Thank you. It's the end of the sutta. That last line is something the Buddha said repeatedly, but it's important to remember it. And when we remember it, it's hard to understand how Buddhism could have got so adapted, accommodated, and embellished. Because the Buddha is only concerned about this one thing. He's not worried, he's not concerned about providing an answer to every question that arises, because he knows that's coming from a fabricated self-referential ego personality. A self-referential ego personality insists on having an answer to every thought, word, and idea that it occurs to it. And it's always a self-referential answer. Look at the questions there. The question that the sectarians are really asking is, what happens to me when I die? There's got to be some way that you can teach me to establish myself in the non-physical realm. And if not, you're either I don't remember the words that he used, a rookie or a foolish elder, if you can't give me that answer. rather than recognizing in themselves that the answer that I'm insisting on having a question, the answer to my question must be given, or that person simply doesn't understand or is so old that they're senile, is a self-reflective way of looking at it, isn't it? I'm asking a question, you better answer it. Well, the question is foolish. It doesn't deserve an answer. And it doesn't deserve an answer because the sectarians are rooted in fabrication, or they wouldn't be asking the question in the first place.
Like you can't answer, you can't ask the question about what happens to the self after death because you don't even understand how the self is before death.
That's right. Unless I bought into a speculative belief system that literally was formed in some respects to provide that answer. So someone might ask me, if you asked me when I was 8 years old, what happens to you after you die? I says, well, I'm not too sure if I'm going to get there, but I'm hoping for heaven. Or something else, or whatever the 700 virgins you get or something. There's another religion. And I'm not putting down any of those religions. All religions, including modern Buddhist religions, promise something after death, don't they? They have to. I mean, don't they? Mm-hmm. Except what the Buddha taught.
It provides solace. It provides support for your ignorant view of yourself.
It provides a way of feeling good in your own ignorance. Rather than, it's something that concerned the Buddha throughout his search for awakening, is something that can be experienced right here and right now. He understood and he experienced it directly, the pain and suffering that comes from establishing yourself in a speculative, non-physical realm. Whether it is because you figured out a way to gain favor from a non-physical god or diva, or you bought into the belief that if I do certain things, I don't really have to worry about my life right now or maybe how confused I am right now, because I know that I'm going to get my reward after I'm dead. Well, what happens in that belief system, even if it's true, that you've just spent your whole life not here because you've established yourself there in this non-physical death experience that is portrayed as being wonderful and a great reward and everything else. Maybe, but you've just lost your life. And you lost your life out of fabrications, and you are living that fabricated life within something called five clinging aggregates. So the significance of that is that we can look at each one of these aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing consciousness. When either one of those fabrications is causing a distraction or stress in our lives, what does the Buddha teach us to do? When I find that it's my feelings that are causing a distraction or stress in my life, what does the Buddha teach me?
Come back to the breath.
And?
Acknowledge what arises.
Uh-oh. We have to go all the way back to the beginning, folks.
In the beginning.
The Eightfold Path.
The Eightfold Path. I mean, right view puts you back into proper perspective.
This is not me. This is
there it is.
This is not who I am.
At any time. That's the quick Dhamma. Whenever any of those aggregates are providing confusion or distraction or distress, identify it. It only takes a moment, takes a breath, and remind yourself, this is not me. It seems to be, for most people that I've taught, including myself, the most difficult aggregate to remind myself is not me is my consciousness, my thinking. Because if the thought occurs to a self-referential ego personality, you have already joined with the thought. Mm-hmm. And that's why it becomes so difficult to recognize and not justify your beliefs, no matter what they brought to your life. And remember, any belief that is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths is a fabricated belief.
Do they all manifest in hindrances?
You're 2 weeks ahead of me. Yes, and they
bunch
do
of brown nosers on this side.
In a very practical way too, because
it makes it easier to apply ill will and the others. It's more real life.
Yes.
And it makes it easier to then go back and then look at the aggregates and back into those I find.
Oh, yeah.
When I sit and those things arise, I tend to lean toward understanding the hindrances, and then it flows back to understanding the aggregates and then all the way backwards.
Yeah, right. Thank you for that. Yeah, the hindrances are the immediate practical experience of fabrications, and so you can say that they're the immediate practical experience of five clinging aggregates, of believing that. And so it is at that point that you can practice. When a hindrance arises, this is not me, this is not mine. And the Dhamma is just that practical and immediate.
That comes right back to the four foundations of mindfulness.
Yep.
Being mindful of your breath, thoughts arising, passing away, feelings, and the quality of your mind.
Yep.
If the quality of your mind is stuck in a hindrance, then you know what's going on, and you can understand that it's from fabricated views, from being in wrong view, and it all kind of just falls apart.
And so, thank you for that, Frank, because that fundamental teaching from the Satipatthana Sutta, what we do in meditation, also includes further on what we do off our cushion, doesn't it? And what we do with that well-concentrated mind that we're developing, and being able to apply it in that way, and noticing the connections between the aspects of the Satipatthana Sutta that speak of feelings and thoughts, and the aspect of five clinging aggregates and the hindrances that speak to the results of those fabricated views. So it all comes back to that. It all comes back to a fabricated view of myself in relation to the world, the three marks of existence.
Like driving up here tonight, there was a lot of traffic. I was stuck behind a lot of slowpokes. I wanted to get to where I wanted to be, and I could feel that stuff arising, and I could just feel it. And I'm just like, this is what's going on, and I could feel it pass away until the next slowpoke got in front of me. And it was like that way all the way to when I got here.
Yeah.
And it did. I really felt calm through the whole thing. And it was just interesting to watch that arising and passing away.
And you're able to maintain a calm and peaceful mind.
And I was saying to Eric, I'm like, that's my five clinging aggregates. That's the teaching tonight.
Yeah, that is. And look at that. All the fabrications that need to develop in order for us to be upset over someone driving too slow. For years and years and years, it just drove me crazy that people, if they were a mile under the speed limit. I mean, for years and years and years, there was this little old guy right in front of me, and always. And he turned the corner, I go down the street, and there he'd be again, in a different car, but the same little old guy.
Right. But it just seems that's the way it goes, you know. But it was funny because we stopped and stopped and get gas. That gas station finally opened, and Eric went for water, and the gas station attendant was very talkative. So he's like, so how's everybody doing tonight? Where are we headed?
Yeah.
I said, I'm heading to Frenchtown for some dinner and some meditation. And he looked at me, he's like, you meditate? And I said, I do. And he's like, why do you do that?
Wow.
And I don't know if I could repeat.
How do you answer that?
Yeah. I said, so you don't see me in an orange suit tonight?
That's a good answer in that setting. Any questions about this? Oh, I want to hear the...
Well, I was thinking that these questions come from not understanding stress, the origination of stress.
Yeah.
The stress of impermanence and the stress of fabrication from the Dukkha Sutta.
Exactly.
So there, because of impermanence, I want to know what happens. I want to know what happens next. I want to know what happens when I die. I want to know what happens after I die.
Yeah.
So that I can buffer the stress of impermanence.
Yeah, and look at what Matt just described. What's going to happen to me?
There's fabrication.
Because we think that way, we may think that that's a reasonable thought. Mm-hmm. But I'm not talking about what's going to happen to me if I cross against traffic. That's just sensible. But what's going to happen to me a million years from now? 1,000 years from now? After I die, do you see all that's just rooted in eye-making?
Right, and outside of the framework of the Eightfold Path, that happens. But when you enter into the path through right view, it changes everything.
It's of no immediate concern. You know, when you'll, and it doesn't mean that you won't fill out the will and give some money to the undertaker for when you're gone. You'll make your plans, but you won't be preoccupied and you won't lose any sleep over it. You'll just know this is part of having a human life. It just is. It's not good that we die at the end of a human life, and it's not bad. It's just part of having a human life. It's not good that we get sick at times, and it's not bad. It's just part of having a human life. It's not bad that I don't always get what I want, is it? But if I'm immature enough, I'm gonna be very upset when I don't get what I want all the time. That's why I say that the best description of an awakened human being is a human being who has developed full human maturity. Because you don't take anything personal. And again, that great description by Matt. Thinking about what's going to happen to me in whatever non-physical realm I bought into is the essence of I-making, isn't it? And again, think about how far we take that. We take it so far that we believe that it's true. When we, even if it, now, you know, I got to be a little careful here. Even if it is true, it doesn't matter, does it? Because I can't know it. What's most important for me to understand, if I'm an authentic practicing Buddhist, is to understand the purpose and scope of what the Buddha taught, which is, I teach stress and the cessation of stress, nothing more.
The sutta with the, when the Buddha was debating the professional debater, and it basically came down to him just proving that you don't have control over these aggregates.
Yeah,
that's what those questions are. You want control over how you'll be remembered and where you'll be, and it's just a false sense of what you are.
Yes, and that's what the Buddha realized, that I'm not any of these things. But what does that leave us as? Remember the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta? Every human being is made up of these six properties, the four elements of earth, wind, fire, and water, the fifth element of space. When you think about that, most people wouldn't add that element to describe a human being. But it took the, maybe the Buddha's not the only one to ever realize it, but if there's no property of space, there's nothing for the other elements to animate in, is there? It takes space. It takes, and the Buddha even describes it as saying that just to have a throat, we need a space in there, don't we? We need an opening. Mm-hmm. So space is as important as, and I'm talking about outer space, space. The space that we occupy as four elements and consciousness. And if the consciousness is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, how is it going to manifest those five properties, those six properties, as five clinging aggregates? But that same consciousness that has developed understanding has experiences those six properties, but their minds, as Frank was able to achieve on the way up here, their minds remain at peace and calm because they understand what's going on. They understand, no matter what people say of me or what I think I should be, there's nothing I can do to change the fact that I have six properties that constitute me, and nothing else. And when you look at it that way, then the only thing that is important to my own well-being is that sixth property in relation to that sixth property in relation to the other five, the way that I think, the way that I view myself, right view, the way that I view myself in reality, in relation to what's occurring around me. Another way of saying that is I don't take anything personal. And I got to say, I don't take a lot personal anymore. Once in a while, something comes up, but it usually has to do with Bodhi. And then let's just take the just a little bit further. Isn't it an incredible understanding to realize that my entire well-being has to do with the way that I think? And that if I understand the Dhamma correctly, when I find fabrications of myself out there that I've created, I need to remind myself, wait a minute, that's not me. This is not mine. This is not who I am. The way that I think in relation, the way that I think framed by the Eightfold Path is what I am. What is that person? It's a person that understands stress. It's a person that understands suffering in himself, in themselves, and in everyone else. In fact, you can say accurately in the entire universe, because according to the Buddha, suffering is the same on Pluto as it is here. It's rooted in ignorance. Isn't that remarkable?
Mm-hmm.
So all that I have to do, very simple thing, is change my view from wrong view to right view. But I don't have to do it by myself. I don't have to figure it out, because somebody else already did it. And he laid out this simple path to end all of my contributions to my stress and suffering and develop full human maturity. That's the end of the talk tonight. Going on enough. Again, any other questions about the sutta, and we'll go around the room. Matt, you covered?
Good.
Thank you. Lorna, good to see you.
Thank you. One or two people tonight have said that, you know, catching the fabrications and thinking about them and catching them when you're going about your day and stuff. To me, my mind is not consistent at that. It's difficult sometimes to figure out if I'm thinking or in a fabrication.
Mm-hmm.
Whether I can see that depends on how I am at that time on that day.
Yeah.
It's not consistent. So obviously I know the teachings in a sort of consistent way, but I can't, because I get caught up in the day, I'm not consistent at following my thinkings.
And so you're not, I'm thinking about something else you said a couple weeks ago, and so in that moment, you're not secluded anymore, are you?
I'm definitely not secluded.
Yeah.
Definitely not.
And so it means that in that moment, you've lost a bit of concentration.
Yeah.
And so how do you know? Sometimes it's impossible to know. You know, we're just so caught up in it.
Mm.
That it's not till we're removed from a situation and maybe hours or even days later we're able to look back on it and realize, wait a minute, that wasn't me. That's not based in reality. But often, if we're finding ourselves agitated in any way, and that could even be feeling extremely blissful over something that really we shouldn't, is a form of agitation. So if you want to understand that and you recognize the agitation in some form, you know that there's a fabrication in place.
Mm-hmm.
Reality never disturbs in that way. It doesn't mean that we don't... it doesn't disturb in a way that we would need it to be different. We understand that suffering is a consequence of living in the world.
But also to not be able to pinpoint the underlying motivation of your thinking at the time can also be disturbing. Because you can't pinpoint if you're eye-making or you're thinking.
Yeah.
And that's disturbing too.
And the best thing to do right now is the prevailing fabrication that's creating the disturbance is that I must be awakened right now and I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see?
Mm-hmm.
And so you can still get at that root cause of impatience is driving this feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can remind yourself how fortunate I am that I have a Dhamma practice that will eventually get me to the point where I recognize this. Because you've recognized and abandoned a terrific amount of fabrications, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we all have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But we all get caught up in that too. That, you know, and that it can manifest. I mean, I would say that's one of the main reasons why people that actually start an authentic Dhamma practice don't continue. Because they get to that point and start blaming themselves harshly. Or the fact that the Dhamma in this moment, my meditation, isn't making me feel any better right now, so the hell with it. You know,
don't you think people get into a mode that they have to throw a no hitter?
Yeah.
And
that's a good way to put it.
That's where doubt creeps in. And it's not that you're failing, it's just the path you're on.
Yeah.
But it's not that sometimes you throw a seven hitter with a couple errors.
Yeah.
But it's as long as you're true to the Dhamma, then that's where you are.
Yeah, and the end is assured. You know, we always think about Ananda when we think about, you know, that it takes time for some people. But think about the life that Ananda had. You know, it was a pretty wonderful life, being living within the Sangha and living with the Buddha, learning all these things. It didn't really matter. He was a little frustrated at the end before he awakened, but it really didn't matter, does it? That we just, the most important thing about the Dhamma is to be gentle with ourselves and engage as wholeheartedly as we can with the Dhamma. And that just means do the best we can. So, thank you for bringing that up. Let me ask, get to Jane, because she's right in line. Jane, how are you?
I'm well. How are you, John?
I'm good. What do you think of tonight's sutta?
I think it was awesome. I'm just sitting here thinking how fortunate and grateful I am that I have my Dhamma practice now.
Me too.
Thanks.
Do you know that Matt's Qigong class is this Saturday and not last?
I do.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. We'll see you soon, too.
Okay.
Ron, good to see you.
Yeah, that agitation is a good tip off that you just fell off your cushion. but to actually, but to catch it when the agitation is actually, you know, when you're feeling just overwhelmingly great, and you think, you know, what's going on here? You know, that's a little harder to catch.
It is, because there's a lot of eye making usually in that.
Mm-hmm.
I've done so many wonderful things. Look at the reward I'm getting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you. Helen, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Thank you. Good to be here. I guess I fully embrace the be gentle with yourself because, you know, or my expectations are that it's not going to happen overnight. We have this interlude between birth and death, and I didn't know when I was going to be born, and I don't know when I'm going to die, but I'm not worrying about either one of them. And so every day that I wake up is another opportunity, and it works.
That's very well said. You know, we don't know when we were born. We really don't. I mean, I know why I was born, but you know, not the purpose behind my life, like there should be. I mean, that the idea that I'm here for a specific purpose is quite self-referential, isn't it?
To wear those glasses.
To wear these glasses. these particular glasses, too. And the note to be distracted by when I'm going to die or I'm going to die, the Buddha would say, you don't have to be worried about birth. You were, you know. And you don't have to be worried about death because you will.
Yeah.
And in between, what do you get to do? Awaken. And we can have some fun, too. We can go to Mexican restaurants with our friends and, you know, laugh at crazy old men. And it's up to us if we want to do this, too. In other words,
right.
the
every day.
Yeah, it's not,
choice.
There's not a religious hierarchy, although there is in Buddhism, but there's not a religious hierarchy within Buddhism, within what the Buddha taught, that says you have to do this. Or you're going to burn in hell, or this or that. Just do this, and you'll awaken. You'll end up, and all the stress in your life, or at least your contributions to it.
Yeah, and you know, when I step off the path, or you know, I just, I don't know, humor works really well on me, and so you know, sometimes I won't say mental fabrication. I'll say figment, and that just makes me laugh. And
that's a good
just
way.
Kind of, you know, caught myself, or, you know, just, I don't know, just, I'm pretty nice to myself, I guess.
Good. That's a great way to put it. It's a figment of my ignorance.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Helen.
You're welcome.
Mary, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to see you. I'm very well. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. It's good to be here and good to be with everyone. I'll take normal size.
Thank you. David, good to see you tonight.
Oh, good job. Thanks.
Thank you. Hi, Bonnie.
Hey,
how are you?
I'm good. And you?
I'm good. Thank you.
you know, every day a little step closer to being, you know, bring that awareness as close to contact as possible.
Yeah. That relates directly to dependent origination, doesn't it? But it's also at the point of contact that five clinging aggregates are manifesting. So.
Or that the fabrication.
Right. Fabrication. Right. And so all of these things are different ways of talking about the same underlying issue of ignorance. And so you can apply the word fabrication to five clinging aggregates, to anatta, to not self-characteristic,
right,
to stress and suffering, to dukkha. It's all part of that. And it's all part of wrong view. So again, the brilliance of the Buddha's teaching is taking us from a fabricated wrong view to a right view, which simply means that I'm viewing myself in relation to the world without any fabrication. That's pretty good. Thank you. Andrew, good to see you.
Good evening. Keep working. Well, it's always so good to participate and rehear these suttas, because it tends to wither away in between. So for that,
yeah, I'm glad you're here. Yeah, it takes continuing right effort, you know. But that's really all that it takes. Frank, good to see you tonight.
It's good to be here, and good to see everybody. How you doing, John?
I'm doing good.
Thanks for responding to my Easter request.
Oh,
it
all worked out?
It was. I was trying to access that Dhammapada 16 through the Podbean. And on that, the link takes you to 15. So I went in through the Becoming Buddha, your webpage, and it took me right to it.
Yeah, it might have been just something a little bit screwy with the app cache. Because I went, as soon as you told me, I went directly to Podbean, and it's displayed properly there, meaning it's displayed properly within their system. So it worked out.
Yeah.
Let me know if it happens again.
I'll show it to you after we're done.
Okay.
But, you know, when I first read the sutta, it kind of, I felt agitated when I read it. The silly questions and stuff like that. Those things, because it's not what the Buddha taught. And go right to the very last paragraph, and he said, I teach stress and I teach cessation of stress. And
yeah,
I can live with that because that's so simple. And, and it helps me in my everyday life. And, you know, from moment to moment, the way I used to be was establish myself in every thought, word, and deed. And there was a lot of suffering for this thing called me.
Yeah.
But now, 3.5 years later, like I said, I could see it arising and passing away. I could see the chain of dependency. I can see the framework of the Eightfold Path and where I need to be. You know, last week was a really busy week for us at the shop, and with so many people interacting from seconds, sometimes 10 seconds, you're interacting with 10, 12, 15 people, and they're all reacting to their own phenomena.
Yeah.
Right.
And that causes a rise in this I, me, my thing, and this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am.
Yeah.
But for me, I think it's real simple to just be mindful of the quality of mind. And because that's like the wheelhouse right there.
Yep.
And when I'm in judgment or I'm in ill will or I'm in doubt or I'm in any kind of mind frame other than peaceful, I come back to my breath and I just realize that I'm caught up for a second.
Yeah.
And every time I abandon a thought or a feeling or a mental quality of mind and come back to my breath, it's impermanent.
Yeah. And you have that direct experience of it.
Yeah.
It is. It's just that way. So, thank you, Frank. Glad you're here. Nick, good to see you tonight. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. I don't really have any comments to make. I'm with you, I guess. It was interesting. I was coming back from New York, driving back from the car show. We went to the car show and went, took the ferry. And I said to myself, there's you are going to hit traffic. It's going to be bad. You're driving at exactly the wrong time. Just be calm. Still hard to do. But I did. I came across a number of situations where I said, okay, I just want to.
Hey, Nick, that's remarkable. You gave yourself the option to not lose your mind,
yeah.
And it's just that way. I don't want to overemphasize it, but that's a direct example of gaining the ability to not lose your mind. You didn't, despite, you know, I talk about that little old man who's always in front of me. I'm the little old man now. Have I gotten in front of any one of you? Okay, I'm it. Russ, good to see you. And it doesn't bother me that much. I'm at peace with it.
I was just thinking about this teaching and the fact that these folks wanted to know, like, the answers to the big questions. Like, you want to cause stress? Try to find the answers to the big questions.
Yeah. Yet we've been doing it forever.
Yeah. And for me, you know, stress is such a part of life, work life, whatever, that those levels of stress don't get me. It's when I start thinking about the retirement and the bigger picture stuff, that's when I get stressed. And that's where I think meditation, that getting back and saying, you know what, I'm ruining the quality of my life today.
Yeah.
I think about that stuff.
Yeah.
That's kind of what this made me think about.
Yeah, again, it's a practical example of how to apply the Dhamma. And the truth of the matter is, the more awakened, the more fully mature you are, the better you'll be to address your retirement in years beyond.
Right.
Or not. You may choose not to. You know, but no matter what, in that normal human process, you'll maintain a calm and peaceful mind.
Right.
Which is what we all want. I mean, even when I was a little kid, frustrated and confused about every single thing in the world, and I didn't realize it at the time, but what I was hoping to and the things that I did were foolish strategies to create a calm and peaceful mind, such as drinking 2 quarts of vodka a day. Eventually I got to that point where I had a calm and peaceful mind. The problem is the next moment I threw up and passed out. But you know, it's not a sustainable practice. But we did. Excuse me for the graphicness of it. But that's why we do things. You know, we everything we do to satisfy a self-referential ego personality. And that's an extreme, you know, not every single thing, but the underlying motivation or intention is to protect this fabricated self. When we let go of the need to protect what is fabricated, peace prevails because there's nothing else to do except live our lives. Great. Any other questions or comments? Oh, I'm sorry, Eric.
Sorry.
A little bit out of position. How are you, my friend?
Good, how are you?
I'm good.
I mean, I didn't have anything to add to it. I was just glad to be here.
Your practice is going well?
Mm-hmm.
Good. All right, next week we're going to study karma and rebirth, and I think that'll just be 1 week. And the week after that we'll finish up with hindrances. I got something else that I might add right at the end, too, that'll kind of fit in with this. But it's been another remarkable Dhamma study, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think all of you, including Nick's probably our newest member, you've gotten a much deeper understanding of the Buddha's Dhamma than you had, say, 3 or 4 months ago, right? You don't have to. You could say no. It's okay.
Well, it also pointed to me out that other things that I really need to go into more.
Like,
well, for me, after the Dukkha Sutta, it was like, I'm only getting, 10% of this. You know, I'm really not living this. So that's going to be, focus for.
And most skillful desire, too.
That's a great understanding, yeah.
Like that sutta last week.
Yeah, that was a Thursday night talk. Yeah. The Piyavaga. There's a lot, I may do that here. But I really encourage you, if you're not, to listen to the Thursday night talks from the last couple of months from the Dhammapada. They're really good, concise, short teachings on one particular subject like that one, on the importance of skillful desire. And I can't remember if it was, because they kind of run together. There's one where the Buddha's teaching, might be this one coming up, about to hold dear, what to hold dear, what to, you could say what to cling ourselves to, but it really isn't. And ultimately what we should hold dear is the Dhamma. Meaning we what we hold dear, we treat as very precious, and we tend to take care of it. Well, we should treat the Dhamma that way. And we should treat Dhamma practitioners that way. Mm-hmm. Because as we learned tonight, it's the whole enchilada.
All sentient beings.
Yeah, I mean, not everybody's likely to take to the Dhamma, but there's a good number of people. I mean, this room is a good example. We were talking a little bit about it before on Saturday, but there's also a handful of people online that are listening to what we do here and developing the Dhamma as best as they can. So, well, we'll finish as we always do. With metta. So again, find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth. And now is the time to meditate. This is the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by the one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Thank you, Jane, for joining. Remember. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.